Welcome to the Vocal Lab Podcast with your hosts, Shelby Rollins and Jason Catrone, bringing you the best from the music industry. Get ready for first-class conversations packed with exclusive techniques and transformative insights, all designed to help you reach your top note. Hey everyone, welcome to today's episode, and we have a really great guest today, Shelby.
Yeah, we do.
Mm-hmm.
We sure do, Jason.
Would you like to tell the people?
This Jason, we have another Jason
on the
set today. This is Jason Jenkins with Curb, the senior vice president. I almost said vice principal.
He would probably agree with that most days.
I think that's my mind. My mom.
Yeah, very similar.
Similar roles sometimes.
My mom mind in like school. I have school-aged children. So the senior vice principal, which is kind of similar, but the senior vice president of Curb here with us today.
Yeah.
Welcome. Marketing. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Happy to be here.
It's great to have you. Jason and I have been friends for a few years, and we like to hit up Sperry's for a good steak and a martini and just talk about the world of music and the world of crazy.
And that's what we're going to do
time.
Today, right?
That's what we're going to do.
The world of crazy
five
music.
Hours.
I know. Oh, we could talk for that one easily.
We could.
No
yeah,
problem.
If we ever do a crazy podcast, it's going to be on. It's going to be on. You'll
invite
be
me back on.
Yeah, you'll just be
you.
A co-host.
Yes, thank you. Appreciate it. A guest appearance.
Yes. Hey, tell us, tell everyone out there a little bit about how you got your start in this crazy business of music and how you found your way to being a senior VP at a major label.
Right, it's because amazing. That's one of those roles that people are like, whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa. Untouchable.
Totally.
As if you just woke up one day, the senior VP of a record label, like, how does that happen? Tell us about your story.
Yeah, it's crazy because I kind of have one of those rags to riches Nashville story.
Oh, I love it.
My parents were in a country band in Middle Georgia.
So I didn't know this. This is cool.
Yeah,
what was the band's name?
The Muddy River Band.
Oh, nice. I love it. So, even better.
My mom was an incredible singer.
Oh, wow.
And then my stepdad was a guitarist, and that's how they met. So
cool. Were they doing their own music, or was it
a lot
of covers?
They did both, actually. My mom had a couple of record deals in Nashville early on from some labels that don't exist anymore.
That's cool.
From the time she was 14, she was singing and coming to Nashville.
Did you sing in the band too, ever?
I did not, but I was always there to introduce them on stage. I
was
like 6 or 7 years old, and I had to be like on the stage at all times. So
nice.
It's that family band thing. You always bring the kids out.
Yeah.
Because it's always a winner. When I was little, side note to interject here, my dad wanted me to be a country singer so bad. That's just what he wanted. He loved country music. And he had two cousins that were in they had a band together. They were married, and it was called Leather and Lace. And I remember being like a 7 year old singing in Leather and Lace sometimes. Like, this is a little weird. I'm seven.
It's a little creepy.
Not supposed to know what this means, but I've kind of figured it out, you know? But back to mom and dad, family band, you're growing up.
Yeah, so I just always had the music bug. Band practice was happening in the living room nonstop, so I learned how to sleep through a lot of noise and banging,
nice.
Which was so fun.
Helps you today.
I was obsessed with singing myself, which I moved on to actually get a vocal performance degree eventually.
Where'd you go to school?
I went to the Southern Baptist Seminary.
Yeah,
you
because,
did.
You know, long story there. We'll dive into on another podcast. But I got a vocal degree and not sad about it. So and so I just was obsessed with Nashville country music. But I listened to a lot of R&B music, which is really weird. Considering my parents were in a country band, so I kind of had this weird juxtaposition.
Who was your first R&B concert?
Oh, R&B concert. Golly, Boyz II Men.
Oh, yeah. That's a great
way
one.
Way back, Boyz II Men.
That's a bucket list one for me.
But we were.
I've never seen
that. Was probably my first like R&B cassette tape.
Oh
was
yeah,
Boyz II Men.
I love a good cassette tape.
Oh, yeah, right.
Amazing.
I saw they tried to bring those back. It didn't really take.
No,
off.
That's it's not vinyl yet. Yeah. You can't do that. Like it's not cool. There's nothing cool and sexy about a cassette player.
Didn't even sound that great, right?
Talked,
of all of them,
oh
it didn't
gosh,
sound that great.
I literally talked to an artist this morning in a session that she's 19. And her brother gave her like it was a record player that also plays cassette tapes, which I didn't even know that existed. And she couldn't figure out for the life of her how to get the cassette tape in there. She's like, and her mom is like, you have to slide the thing in at an angle. And she's like, what? Anyway,
so like
I just laughed.
Slip.
Remember that?
I laughed and cried at the same time.
That
I was
time
like, oh,
period
gosh.
Where cars had a cassette player and CD player.
Oh yeah.
Through
the
conversion.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that was.
That was a catalog.
And the CD player with the cord thing that you had to plug the cassette into. Yes. You stuck the cassette in so the CD player could play. That was like a, I think we're dating ourselves.
We really are. Let's move on to other topics.
So, I went to college, moved back home for a second just to figure out what I wanted to do. And one day I was just like, I got to go to Nashville. That's what I have to do. So I legitimately packed up my Honda Accord. I worked for Publix at the time as a customer service manager.
Amazing.
So I had a job when I moved here. Yeah. And
we're shopping is a pleasure.
I know. I had my big tube TV in my back seat and a bunch of clothes on top. And I found a roommate on roommates.com because that was a thing back then.
Nice.
And he also worked for Publix, so I was like, okay, at least if you're a serial killer, I know how to catch you, you know. But
I know where you work.
I lived on an air mattress in his floor for a while, and I applied for jobs as soon as I got up here. I actually got hired within 2 months in kind of a mailroom type position.
Mm-hmm.
I was a credit at Word Entertainment, so I was doing the Christian
music
thing.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that's a classic story, starting in the mailroom.
I know.
Starting in the mailroom.
Well,
really
it was
is.
Like the proverbial mailroom situation because I was a collection agent. I called Christian bookstores every day, all day, and said, now, Donna, I need you to send the money or we're not going to send you more CDs.
You owe us money.
and Donna would be like, oh,
God. I didn't know this was a thing.
Yes, we had a whole department. We had like 15 people doing this at that time.
Oh,
so
wow.
When the CD was alive.
Oh, my gosh.
So I did that for about a year, and then I moved into A&R. So I was like, I got to get out of this, you know. So, and then I've been in finance and marketing and live events and all kinds of stuff since then. So I kind of landed here.
Was there someone at the company that saw something in you that would be like, hey, this guy gets A&R
marketing. Let's get
marketing.
Him out of the
mail Let's room. Move him out of this. Or was it something you just expressed interest to and it kind of found its way to the people that needed to find
That's
it?
That's a good question.
I had to fight pretty hard because
those are coveted
is not,
jobs.
No, yeah, and the music industry is not known for people like observing others' talents as far as inside the industry.
Yeah.
It's more because, you know, you're so concerned about your creativity and what you're bringing to the table that you're not always looking for, you know, the next up-and-comer internally. So you really have to claw and fight and show your worth a lot.
Sure.
So
for
those of you,
a flaw in the system, to be
honest.
Sounds
like it.
You know, because if it's... correct me if you feel like this is not really the right vantage point, but do you feel like maybe... since the music industry as a whole is so somewhat self-indulgent and insecure, because we're all looking at like, am I bringing my A game? Am I going to get cut? Am I going to get dropped from my label or whatever? Because even once you arrive at some level of success, there's still a lot of fear around maintaining that level, right? But the people that are moving up through the ranks or whatever, when we're so... looking internally at me, you know, and I feel like I have to parent my own kids through this, that walk through their own levels of like insecurity in childhood and like figuring out who they are and their place in the world. When we don't ever graduate from that in our mind and mature to see outside of ourselves and to look at other people, then we create cultures like this in any industry, but maybe more so in music because it is already so the creative industry can be somewhat self-indulgent, right? To never really be looking at others and how can I lift somebody else up and spot the gold in that person and draw that out because I'm thinking like a leader, but instead I'm thinking like that poverty mentality, that scarcity mentality of like, I have to hold on to my position.
Mm.
Well, it's not only that, but it's the music industry alone is a very big industry. So there's only so many jobs. You know, I went to Belmont.
Just I don't know. There were 15 people asking Donna for money.
Well, that's true. Well, I'll get to that point in a second. We'll let him
the collections in. Thing.
Oh,
yeah.
You're
yeah.
like,
oh,
wait, what?
That Donna. I was that like, who's Donna? And then I'm like, wait, that's my story.
Your story.
Yeah. No, you know, I went to Belmont. I forget how many people Belmont alone, that school alone, churn out a year with music business degrees. Mm. And there aren't that many jobs open just down the street on Music Row where his offices are off that row. And so it's a very small industry, so it does become quite protective.
No.
But on top of that, the creative space inside of this bigger industry, there are collections people, there's accountants, there's all kinds of people at labels and every auxiliary service. But the creative side, which you're in, marketing and from A&R perspective, those are the coveted jobs because it's the fun job inside the big, big machine, right?
Right.
And so A&R, for those of you who don't know, it stands for Artists and Repertoire. You can maybe talk a little bit about some of the things you did in that role and continue to do in finding and developing artists.
Yeah, it's now such an even smaller cesspool of you know, when I started.
Like you said,
I know, I was like, wait a minute.
A good cesspool sometimes, but, you know, it's a much smaller world than it was even, mm-hmm. you know, 18 years ago when I started. Mm-hmm. And, it, you know, there are less jobs and everyone's kind mm-hmm. of just dabbling in every different department because it kind of takes that effort. Right. And the labels have been working hard to evolve and stay relevant and mm-hmm. And to make sure that they're providing value too. Like mm-hmm. labels have a bad rap among a lot of artists, but really there is, you know, I'm not just saying this because I work for one, but I found my place in that world because we do bring a lot of value. We do actually care a lot. And most mm-hmm. of the people on our side of the industry are artists in some rhyme or reason or some sort of method of artistry.
Yeah.
Even
sure.
the finance people, they could go make probably triple the amount of money working at, you know,
Wall
Chase
Street
Bank or
yeah,
whatever.
Right.
That's a really valid point.
But in our industry, they would rather make a little less money and do something they're very passionate about. Mm-hmm. And they have some big passion for music and artistry. So
yeah.
I think you have that. And that's why the jobs are so coveted.
Mm-hmm.
And then people kind of get into it and flounder a little bit and like, where do I belong? I did that. I was like, I want to do X. And then, you know, I get into it and I'm like, oh, this is not really that fun anymore.
Yeah.
And it's just a lot more stressful than I think a lot of people realize.
That's a really valid point you bring up too, because it is very obvious to most of the world that labels and even the streaming services now do get bad raps consistently. It's mm-hmm. rare you hear someone say, oh, I love that label.
And yet, ironically, people are dying to get signed to a label.
Totally. True. And they're dying to hear more music. And mm-hmm. so it is.
They want that 800-pound gorilla to push them up the hill. Mm-hmm. They want the
sure.
leverage.
So
right.
there is such value that you add. And it's mm-hmm. really cool to hear you talk about maybe the softer, more human side of the business
totally.
That you're in.
Yeah.
And I know that about you because we're friends. Mm-hmm. But it for people who don't know, they just hear all these bad stories. And you know, historically even started from like the mob running the music
right.
business, right? It's like,
yeah.
if you didn't pay your bills, Donna was dead, right? That was a whole different day.
Donna, we're going to talk about Donna all day today.
You should have been in collections in the 70s. You could have like knocked a few people off.
Oh my.
But,
oh wow, we're getting rowdy.
Hey,
rowdy.
Hey. But no, it is really cool to hear you talk about the internal side of your team of people and the people you interact with every day.
Yeah.
Because with us on the creative side, primarily we're interacting with the artist mm-hmm. and so we get that space mm-hmm. in between the two of you at times
totally
where they're frustrated because I just got off a call with Jason and they're not giving me the money for this budget and mm. I feel like my career's over. What do we do? And then Shelby and I have to sit there and be like, hey, it's okay, there are budgets. And you know,
and we have to be friends with both sides,
right?
We're like on both teams, you mm-hmm. know, and that can be challenging. But
yeah. Who are some of the artists you're excited about right now? And maybe give people a little history on Curb itself, because we got fans
right, because every
over
label kind of has its own little like niche in the music yeah. industry. So what do you feel
yeah.
like is Curb's?
The cool thing is it's Curb's 60th anniversary this year. So that's pretty. I'm actually
happy
producing
birthday.
A show at CMA Fest at Ascend on June 6th. So
oh, cool.
We have our whole roster of country artists performing.
Amazing.
And who are they?
We have Lee Bryce closing it out, Dylan Scott, Rodney Atkins, Sawyer Brown, who's newly re-signed to the label.
That's cool.
Hannah Ellis, Kelsey uh-huh. Hart, Harper Grace, Pitney Meyer. We have Tim Duggar. We have a whole roster. I'm like,
that's really cool.
A bunch of people. But
I'm
running that whole entire show, which is always fun to get a bunch of artists together when they're like, I should get this much time and I should go here. And everybody's been super great, honestly, but it's just always a little bit of a challenge. With that many creative people, and everybody wants to make their set special. So Curb has such a crazy history with some of the biggest names in country music. Mm-hmm. Tim McGraw's entire, I would say the bulk of his big stuff came out of Curb,
mm-hmm.
From the Indian Outlaw days, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Hank III, the Judds, Leanne Rimes,
wow.
Like we just did a reissue of the Coyote Ugly soundtrack because it did so well back in the day, and we did a whole reissue this last year. So
yeah.
There's a lot of history in Curve that people don't know because we're not the big monster. You know, I worked for Warner for quite a few years, and that was easy to say on the street. Like, I worked for Warner Music, and they're like, "Oh yeah," and I'm like, "Curve," and they're like, "Who? Curd?
Curd?"
I'm like, "No," I was like, "No, Burr Curb." So, yeah.
It's probably common too. Also, if you're not from Nashville, you may not even know the word curb at all.
Correct.
But you know, but in Nashville, Curb after Mike Curb, the owner, there's so many buildings around this town named after him. And he's had such a huge influence on the industry as a whole in keeping not only country music alive, but music in general. Because his whole life passion, from what I know, has been to reinvest from his benefits and blessings into keeping music relevant and alive, and it's a pretty magical legacy that he leaves.
Sure,
he's an artist himself. He's still here, and he started, I believe, he started his first record label when he was 17.
Are you kidding?
So he's been passionate. Yeah, the label in California. And
wasn't he lieutenant governor or something?
He was. He was. He's done. And then he was under Reagan. He became governor of California when Reagan went to the White House. And then he has a long history. Still very involved in politics and advocates for a lot of different groups of people. Very involved in the community. And that's one of the reasons I love it so much, because I'm not a number on a spreadsheet. Mm-hmm. I am. By the way, no one told me to say any of this. I wasn't prepared. But. I'm a person, you know, when the tornado hit my house, he called me and was like, "What can you do? What can we?" Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were in the house and were dislocated for probably a year.
This was just, 3 years ago?
2020.
Yep. Yeah, right before
COVID. In March. Mm-hmm. Yep, it was a great year.
Oh, my word.
That's the other podcast, remember?
That's the other podcast. But yeah, he's just a very compassionate person and very involved with, like, social issues, and very involved with employees. So I think he's the same way for our artists, too. Like, he really cares deeply for the artists. They're not just, you know, revenue streams on a spreadsheet, which is a welcome change for me coming from the bigger box systems. So, yeah.
That's really neat.
Yeah, again, I think it's really cool to hear, like, a very, I keep going back to sensitive, tender side of the music business.
Yeah, it does exist.
Yes. Yeah, it does exist. And it must exist for great art to still find its way.
Yeah.
I think. And it seems that can get lost in music from the media we hear by and large, but you know, in the art world, I have some friends that are really big in the art world, or getting bigger in the art world, and you know, in that space, it's still really common to find a benefactor to help you make your art. In a space like we're in today, you'd be in here just painting or sculpting, whatever you're doing, and you have a wealthy person or people who just give you money, they believe in you, help you do that. And we've lost that. Obviously, that's kind of how the business started of music.
Yeah.
And it got so successful and popular that it kind of became more than that. So it is really cool to hear that there are still moments and spaces and places where the music is still the forefront, and the art and helping artists achieve what they want to do.
Yeah.
Because it does take money and smart marketing and stuff like that.
And we're in this weird intersection of technology and music, which we know with DSPs, et cetera, which are very necessary. And there's always been some sort of challenge, whether it's, you know, retail, selling your stuff into Walmart or radio or DSPs, et cetera. There are always going to be those mediums that labels have to work hard to maintain relationships with. But I think now more than ever, the people who work in the industry care more about the art than I venture to say maybe they ever did. It's less businessy on the label side than
that's hugely encouraging
than it used to be.
And maybe because to be in this industry, you have to care more about it, or otherwise, like, what is the point? Because it's harder to make money. And
we also almost for a little while felt like through that transition into, like, streaming.
Right.
You know, we kind of all wondered, does it go away?
Right.
Especially from your perspective.
Oh, yeah, we were
right?
all like,
you're like,
oh,
where's every the money day? Come from?
Yeah. Right.
We're, you know, just counting down the days as we see like dwindling CDs off of the shelves and stores and Best Buy getting rid of its music section and all of those
so
things.
So wild.
Yeah.
So
what
be
is,
on the inside during those transitional years and all of that, it's just really, really
That's what
crazy.
I'm loving about this podcast series that we're doing.
Yeah.
Is that I'm understanding deeper the other parts of the business that I'm not daily involved with.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I have my mindset of what I think it is and little stories here or there where I've interacted at times, but that's really cool to hear some of these perspectives of your side of the table. What do you think is the greatest challenge where you are in your position in at a label in marketing today? Like to help your artists get their music out, what is the big challenge?
Two things I would say: authenticity and conveying that, and then breaking through the noise, because there are so many. Anyone can set up a studio and and make music and put it out on Spotify on their own,
right?
So I mean, you have millions of songs probably daily being uploaded by all these different people, and you kind of have to figure out what your avenue is going to be to get noticed, to kind of rise to the top. But what we deal with on a daily basis with artists is how do you express your authenticity? How do you, cause we're constantly like, you got to post on social media and they're like, rah, 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 and I'm like, I don't either. But,
I've worked with so many artists who don't have any desire to post on social media and I get it sort of, but at the same time, like, but you gotta.
I do things in my job all day that I don't want to do.
And that's how I try to help artists understand it. Like this is your job. You're really lucky that this is your job. The alternative is one of these jobs. Let's list them now.
Right.
And you still have to do things in these jobs you don't want to do.
Totally.
Take your choice. You know, and they always come back to, okay, I get it. Yeah. It's still a struggle.
And it doesn't mean it's not hard. I get it.
I think one of the struggles people have with being on social media is that they have a hard time being authentic on social media.
Totally.
Because it's
different. They freeze when the camera comes on. They're like,
I can be myself when I'm interacting with my friends, but then to capture that and put that out there for the world to see is hard. And I had to, when I was really trying to up level my social media game as a business person, as a vocal coach, and I hired somebody, a social media manager, to help me do that so that I could actually be consistent with posting, because otherwise I was just not going to happen. I'm not an editor. I don't know how to do that kind of stuff. But I knew how to talk about the things that I liked, and I'd been on camera a lot. But I realized that there was still something missing of my personality when I tried to be on the social media side. And there was a learning curve. It took time. It took iterating and experimenting and doing bad reels for a while, you know, to get to that point of like you flush it out and you start to get to the good stuff. And I think it's just consistency, continuing to show up and just do it. Do it even if you think it sucks. Like, show up, keep going.
So how do you help them through that process? Because it's almost every artist.
It's every artist.
If they get it already, they usually come to you that way.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah. And there are, and I mean, we even have, you know, we work with artists that have it down, but they just get exhausted by it. And I get it. Like I do. And they don't, you know, they don't think we get it a lot of times, but I'm like, because I don't have to post on social media for my job. I post like one post up every 6 months or something. I'm not super active, but I, you know, I see the flip side of the coin, and I'm like, this is your brand. And I'm like, why would you not want to talk about what you're passionate about?
Yeah.
And you can do it in your own way. Never, ever will we say this is how you have to present this information. There are people that have different schools of thought on that, but never once will I sit with an artist and say, you have to say it like this in this manner under the... That's not... I want you to be as authentic as possible and just do what feels most comfortable. Some are comfortable doing dance, you know, challenges or whatever, and some are just... feel better hiding behind a plant and, you know, singing or whatever. Yeah. And I don't know where that came from, but
that was
it sounds good.
That was Sia.
That we have here. Yeah.
But it is an ongoing, every
she
artist
definitely
is different.
Was hiding behind
she's like,
it worked for her.
She literally made that her brand.
She
like,
did.
I hide it's behind my hair.
Quite
I hide
fascinating.
Behind
yeah.
whatever
actually, I want to do that.
Like, it's really fascinating.
She made some, probably because she didn't really want to be seen on social media, but knew that she had to.
I'll never forget that first time on the Ellen show, she sang backwards with that wig.
I remember being incredible.
Oh, the really funky
one.
Yes.
She sang backwards, and you never saw her face. I was like, that's brilliant. It was weird, but it was brilliant.
Yeah. definitely made me know who she was.
Yeah, well, again, you touch on a great point, which we've done a series on, and we'll obviously continue to, the authenticity of yeah. art. And it's obviously what helps you initially probably notice someone more to even consider signing them for a deal. Have you ever signed anyone that's not been authentic to who they are? It doesn't mean they don't grow still. Obviously, there's growth in everything, but...
Yeah, I would say, like, I mean, we've definitely worked with artists that did not have that fine-tuned. I think it's less so these days because, yes. you know, we have so many mediums we can explore. Like, when we can see them on social media, we can see right. unsigned artists easily. On the flip side, unsigned artists can, you know, if they've really gotten in a groove and built their following, they don't necessarily need... They're making revenue. So
that's true.
That's where it's challenging for a label, because we have to we have to come in and be like, here's where we can bring value.
Yeah. Fascinating point.
Can you talk more about that?
Yeah.
Like, when an artist, sort of that line between an independent artist who is making some revenue, doing what they're doing, and then you figuring out how you can elevate and add value to that.
Yeah, for sure.
How do you attract those people? How do they attract you?
It's a very... delicate song and dance, yeah. No pun intended or pun intended. I think the thing is it's a relationship building industry. So like everything we do is relationship. So Nashville is not a big town. The music yeah. industry is not a big industry even outside of Nashville. So you know, everything is built on authentic relationships, and that's right. what we try to convey to the artists too. Is like, hey. You know, there's got to be a reason we want to work with you and a reason you want to work with us. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, if you've reached a certain level on social media or whatever, and you have this level of talent, you know, you're going to probably be hit up by a lot of labels yeah. and a lot of different mediums and people that just want to pay for you to do whatever. We've also learned in this TikTok era that not everyone who's amazing on TikTok translates as an artist, because you can be great in front of that camera, but you step on a stage mm-hmm. and it does not, it's a completely different translation.
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. kind of like the difference when people like get in the recording booth versus perform live. They're very, very different art forms.
And also and just the sets. Reality that like not every artist is going to translate.
Correct.
Like
yeah.
musically.
Yeah. And that's where it's hard for us is like, we have to guess a little bit, you know, mm-hmm. And it is a gamble. It is a bet of sorts. And so we try to do a little bit more of a relationship build with them in the initial stages versus just being like, hey, you want to sign this deal, you know, and let's yeah. run in here and let's develop yeah. you. And mm-hmm. it's less developing now.
That's what I'd heard.
Yeah.
That, mm-hmm. you know, a few years ago, development deals were everywhere. Mm-hmm. But you could sit on a label and never go anywhere.
Right.
But they had you in this development deal. And now that's kind of been alleviated because of social media.
Yes.
Right? By and large.
For the most part, yeah.
Yeah. And there's a lot of independent people doing artist development on their own.
Sure. We do some of that.
So we do some of that. Yeah. And then, you know, publishing sometimes is now doing that
yeah,
as well.
Of course. Yeah.
It's publishing has their own A&R and has the whole field going. And a lot of times, though, artists will come out of the publishing world and do the more fan-facing side.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes artists go into the publishing world because they're like, I don't really want to do the... it's kind of a shift in like finding out where they want to be. Like yeah. we really do want to hear like, what do you feel good doing? Because if you don't feel good doing something, then it's not gonna come across authentic yeah. and
it's not gonna work.
Now in your role now as the senior VP versus when you were doing A&R, how much of those different independent artists sort of come into your radar, and how did they do that? Like, how would somebody who is independent, who would love to be picked up by a label, mm-hmm. how would they sort of come into your orbit so that they can be noticed? And to your point originally of being in the mailroom and really kind of clawing your way for the job that you wanted, is that a viable way for an artist to get noticed? I mean, there's the hustle and the relationship building, but you know what I mean? From that standpoint of, you don't just rest on your laurels and hope that your talent is discovered without doing something about it. But then there's that side of it that people lean away from that feels gross and kind of like, you know, listen to my demo kind of stuff that feels sleazy.
Yeah.
For lack of a better word. You know what I mean? So I guess I'm asking like three questions, right? But like, how do these artists come into your orbit? Does it happen more in your, where you're at now? Do you sort of interact with that? Or do you lean more on the A&R side for them to bring people to you?
I think it leans more on the A&R side, but in our small industry now, everyone's doing a little bit of A&R. We always have our antenna up looking for someone who's going to be a great fit. And, you know, very rarely do I bring someone to the table because, A, it's not my full-time job, and I want the people who do that to really focus on it. But B is I have, you know, once they're inside the system, maintaining that relationship and helping build their career is where my big focus is. So
probably what you've discovered you really enjoy the most.
I do. Yeah, I really do, because, you know, I relate to it so much. And it's hard to convey that to artists because they're like, you're in the business side. And I'm like, I have been an artist my entire life. I know what it's like to be self-conscious. I know I've been on stages. I've performed. I've done all the things. Like, I didn't just pop up here as a business guy, and I have no clue what it's like to feel any of these pressures.
Right.
It's hard to convey that to them, but I think it helps make me better at my job. It helps me relate to them because I feel like when they're struggling, I feel it. When we have these hard conversations about social media or whatever, I'm like, I get it. I would suck. I know I would suck at this if I were in your shoes. But, you know, I'm not trying to put the weight of the world on your shoulders. I'm just trying to say that it's not the day where you just go record music in a studio and be like, okay, label, go. You know, it's not that day anymore.
Spoken like someone who was at a seminary. it's very like mentoring and pastoral, your perspective on your role in the business side. Right. And that's what makes you effective in that, obviously.
And that's what I love the most, the relationship and pouring
it's
in.
So personal at that point.
Absolutely. Sometimes it's hard because I'm not marketing a MacBook, right? It's not going to wake up tomorrow and, you know, post something on Instagram and we have to change our entire direction. Right. Like the product is the product, but in here, the quote unquote product is a person. It's a human being with feelings, with challenges, with life stories, with all of those things that could change on a daily basis. And so you're constantly in this dance of making sure you never see them as a product. Like my goal is to never see an artist as a product, even though we have metrics we look at.
Right.
It's the human behind it all. That's what makes them special. They have a talent. They have all of these different components that came together to make them an artist, but they're sitting in front of me for a reason. They didn't just pop up and didn't work to get to where they are.
And prioritizing that human and that authenticity is what gives you the metrics you want anyway.
Right. Right. Totally. Yeah. The metrics will follow. And of course, we're logging metrics and creating charts and all of that stuff. But that's our boring job, you know, the boring side of our job. I try to tell the artist, hey, don't worry about that as much. Like, you're going to look at your following, et cetera. But like, just focus on what you want to say and who you want to be.
That's so good.
And it's hard because they're like, but I only have 12 followers. And I'm like,
well, what do those 12 people want to hear?
I know. Yeah. Exactly. And then you can get 13.
Yeah. So, from a business standpoint, I've heard somebody say, like, the person you're most qualified to reach is the person you once were. Mm. And I think that can really be impactful in any industry, whether that's in coaching, right, or in artistry, where, hey, who's the artist? Who's the little kid that you were a million years ago that you were hoping one day to be maybe in the position that you're in now? Because we can overcomplicate this kind of stuff. We can get too in our head about what to post and how to show up online authentically. But go, who was I once? You know, and how have I now grown? Is that the person I want to reach now? And it's probably the person I'm the most qualified to reach is the person that I used to be. Mm. And so if you can just speak to that one person, then you're probably going to tap into something incredibly authentic that more than one person is going to really relate to. You know, that's when I think the people who are very successful at this on the online space, they do that well. It feels like they're talking to you directly. Yep. You know, like, man, that person's like reading my mail. You know,
and that's where Taylor Swift really
it
that Taylor effect. I mean, she just everyone is her best friend. You know,
I've always said
and
that.
Like,
yes.
It's like it's so.
No. Like, why do people love her?
Feel, it's
because they feel like
infectious.
They're meeting their best friend, and they see her in concert. You know, and especially I feel like in the early years of her stuff was I thought she was really really good at that. I'm not saying she's not now, but
no, it's true.
I think
it's
it was really
true.
a strong point for her in her growth.
You know, I mean,
yeah,
so many people because she. She was that artist, especially at the back end of, you know, the divas of the 90s that were singing all these big power ballads.
Mm-hmm.
She was that artist that came out of that, that just let us hear her entire love story and all the pain and struggle. And everyone from 8 to 82 related to it in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a real brilliance in that authenticity. You know?
Yeah. And when she's been criticized about stuff, whether that was her weight or what, she was just kind of like, I'm not here for you. Like, I don't need your permission to gain weight, to lose weight, you know, because then people freaked out because she lost weight. And she was like, what? Listen to yourselves, you know? And I think that that was very relatable because she was very honest and kind of like, I don't give two craps about your opinions. I'm not here for you. Even though she's here for us, right?
Yeah.
Ironically, it's like,
the
I'm
weird.
The approval is not based and contingent on the, or how do I say that differently? Her value, her worth is not contingent on her approval, but she's there for those people to share her worth and value. You know what I mean? And I think that's something that gets lost in translation. And we can maybe overcomplicate. We were talking about that before, overcomplicating things and like keeping it. We were talking about another episode about keeping the voice simple. Our job is to remove obstacles from people. They're overthinking stuff. Like, hey, it's easier than you think. You got to reframe. You got to reframe this.
That's the biggest issue in all of this, though, is overthinking, because artists want to categorize everything. So they want to be like, okay, this is my social media person. This is my songwriting person. This is my performance person. And really, it's all the same.
It's all
that's
the same
where
team.
Like Adele, people like Adele and Taylor Swift, they you have to like have some level of I don't care. You know, like you care
to.
But you don't care. Like you have to not care so much.
Can't care
and, like,
so much.
Right.
Yeah.
You're
about
just gonna get yourself all worked up and I'm like, I do enough of that in my own like life. You know.
Right. Control what you can control and then like detach from the results. Right.
Yeah. I think someone once told me, I don't know who it was, but they told the story about Elvis. When he fell off the stage one time, he just hopped back up and started singing again. And it was like,
isn't that in the movie? I feel like
it might have been. I mean, that's highly embarrassing, especially in his day and time, right? And his level of fame, like everyone was going to talk about that, but he didn't care so much that it kept him from going on. And it really is. It's a space we work a lot in with our artists, is to help them not care too much, strive for perfection or for excellence, but not hold the badge of perfection too high over your head, because none of us are perfect. And
nobody wants to hear that.
And no one wants to hear
right.
perfect. And singing, I think we referred to this on another episode too, but in singing, it's the only sport I know where we think we have to be 100%. And if we're not, we self-inflict some kind of wound on ourselves. And that starts to judge and inform everything else we're doing. And it's no, we're really, I remember it was a few years ago when Idina Menzel sang at the New Year's Eve, rockin' New Year's Eve thing, and she sounded horrible. I mean, it was awful. She had a cold. No one knew. They didn't say, here's Idina to sing her big song from Frozen.
But she's sick, guys.
But she's sick.
So,
they didn't say that, you know?
Nobody's qualifying.
And it's also why you typically don't pick songs that are just out of the roof, although I work with an artist of his, Wynn Starks, who's one of the best singers on the planet. Check him out, you guys. Wynn Starks.
Incredible.
Lovely human. Incredible. You see him in show, you're just like, on one hand, you're like, how is this possible? The other hand, you're just in tears because he's so great. And then he just hugs your neck and you're just still in tears, right?
So
he's so amazing. And but he's an artist who still sees me as someone who can help him. And I look at him and go, I don't know what I can do for you. You're insanely talented. Other than keep you healthy and mentally
And that's sometimes
check.
Exactly what
and
they
that's
need.
What he needs. Yeah. That's all he needs from me, right? But he comes in thinking I can teach him something. He's always like, Jason, what are you going to teach me today? I'm like, Wynn, there's nothing I can teach you. I'm going to help you be you. But, but you know, there's an artist where, like, you and I both know him. It's like, does he ever have a bad day? Of course he does.
Yeah.
But he's got these songs that are just like, over the top, these high notes. Like, how does he keep doing this? So, yeah, she has this big song from Frozen, this big, huge note. She's under the weather. Does not sound good. It's around the world for New Year's Eve. And the next day, I mean, not even, just right after on social media, but also just the, you know, reviews of the show and everything, she's getting butchered. Mm. And she comes out with this amazing statement. I can't remember for sure. You should look it up. But basically, she just said, I'm human. I'm an artist with a voice, and I operate 80-20. 80% of the time, I'm on point. That makes me a professional. The other 20%, you're going to get what it is. And I'm like, that's pretty brilliant. Yeah. Every artist needs to see themselves that way.
Well, and athletes, we talk about athletes all the time, but like professional athletes and even guys who are great shooters in basketball, mm-hmm. for instance, actually statistically miss more shots than they make.
Mm. Yeah.
You know what I mean? But we concentrate on like the stats of like how many good shots they make, right? What's mm-hmm. their percentage of that? But the reality is, and baseball is probably the same. You're going to have more strikes than home runs.
Oh, of course.
But we don't seem to criticize that if the home runs are outnumbering or not outnumbering, but they're shining and you're adding value to your team. But in music, it's true. It's cutthroat, man. People are like, you are not allowed to miss a note.
Nope.
You are not allowed to do, like, how dare you get on that stage if you're not going to be perfect? And that's, it's unfortunate. But
the national anthem is a key component of that. Like, which
I hate having to coach people through that.
Like, when, oh my gosh, he just did it at the Brooklyn Nets game a couple of months ago. Mm-hmm. And I hear him sing all the time, and I just had chill bumps just going crazy because it's just so incredible. But it's such a hard song.
And it is
hard. And he didn't even have a pitch pipe. Like he just goes
just
like,
starts.
And I was like, we should
good.
Probably get you a pitch pipe just so you feel good, you know, but and he's like, that'd be great. But, but he doesn't need it either. Like he's just so good. And you know, he's like, I don't want to just sing the national anthem, but I'm like, but you realize how many people who can't sing this song? It's just...
There's so much anxiety around singing that
it
song,
is.
Too.
Mm. And there's so much, like, the crazy thing about music and any art is that you're putting your vulnerability on display. Like,
absolutely.
Athletes, they go out there, their life struggles, you know, it's similar to stepping on stage, but, like, a lot of the artists are performing songs that come from their life. Like,
right.
They don't get to completely disassociate from what's going on in their personal life.
Right,
so
you're right.
The vulnerability is on display. Like, a painter, like,
that's a
you know, that
point.
Came from some depth. It didn't just pop out of you. Mm-hmm. You weren't just like, I'm gonna scribble on some paper. Because anybody could do that. But, like, it came from a space, and it's like... And then people are looking and listening to your vulnerability, and it's like, ooh.
And what's crazy, too, I think about an artist, I always say that I think singing is the most vulnerable art form that exists. Mm-hmm. Because a painter, while they're doing that exact same thing, they usually paint that in private and mm-hmm. then put it out there, and it's like, I'm already done. I already fleshed out my feelings on the canvas, and now you can judge it. Whereas an artist is fleshing out their feelings live, night after night after night.
Yep.
For an audience to have to see. And your voice is the only instrument that's not made by man, right? It's in your physical body. So it's incredibly personal. And because it's attached to your speaking voice, because it's the same muscle, right? It's the same thing. Like it or not, for better or worse, whether this is healthy or not is not the point. It is in forever attached to our identity,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so that's why there's, I think, so much... just anguish for artists over this kind of stuff. And I deal with this if any time, like, I have a theater background. I did a lot of musical theater before moving into like pop only. And I end up coaching sometimes theater people who are transitioning into more pop stuff. And it's always this thing of, I have their vulnerability always comes up. It was like when I was an actor, I could totally do these things, but now I'm singing my own songs mm-hmm. that I wrote, and it's like so much more vulnerable because I'm having to be myself, and they don't know how, and it's very real.
See that with a lot of actors I work with too, and dancers. You know, this one thing that they're even musicians. They're really this their primary thing. They want to do voice, and it's always the hardest. It's mm-hmm. always the hardest.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it's the one we hold so tender and dear as well.
Yeah.
You know? And that's why we need people like you to...
to help us see that there's humans behind the business
that
care about you as a musician.
That are just really trying to connect all these other parts from the business aspect mm-hmm. of that humanity and authenticity so that music, again, great music and great artists can just find their way.
Yeah.
And that's what's fun about it.
I think a challenge too with it is that some artists will see that, you know, when I'm saying, hey, I need you to do X or whatever, you know, it's like this, oh, well, you know, y'all just need to make money off me. And I'm like, I have a job tomorrow, the next day, the next day, the next day. Like, what I'm trying to do is legitimately help you with a career. Like, I mean, I'm trying to help you not self-sabotage, because I have worked with hundreds and hundreds of artists, and I've, and a tiny fraction of those have gone on to be recognizable names. So you have to really, really want it. You have to not look for every excuse to be like, I don't want to do this because blah. You know, I mean, you just sometimes just have to suck it up. And like most of us do in our careers. But like, there are plenty of things we don't like to do and plenty of people we don't like working with. But guess what? We have a job to do. And we're just lucky enough to do something we're super passionate about. Like,
that, and it's really fun.
Dream about. Like, I dreamed about this as a kid. Like, I get to, when I'm frustrated, I look at it and I'm like, people would kill to have my job.
Yes.
And I also would kill to have my job. Right. You know, even on the worst days.
We're about to kill you to take your job.
Right. Totally.
Please,
you mentioned something that I kind of want to ask you about. I know we probably should wrap it up, but I want to ask this. You mentioned you can see when artists are starting to self-sabotage. What are some of the most common ways that artists do that? Sort of throw those proverbial hand grenades into their own business.
Yeah, it's more common than not. I mean, getting in their head, honestly, is the biggest thing. And just overanalyzing and thinking everyone's out to get them. And that's a common thing from everything from, you know, musicians and their band to it is that what we talked about earlier. We're kind of like protective of our creativity and like it is a small industry and we don't want anybody to steal that away from us. But instead of being confident in who they are and what their talent is and what they bring to the table, they do like a lot of us do and get very insecure about it. But the problem is that they are a face to the public. And we're not. Like, when I have a bad day, nobody sees that I have a bad day.
Yeah.
When they have a bad day, everyone sees it. So it's it's not leaning into that. They should, you know, I encourage artists to lean into it and say, like, if you're having a bad day, it's okay to, like, I'm having a bad day. Yeah. Like, you're a normal human. Like, please be a human. Like, don't feel like you have to be a robot ever. And I think they, and also what I said earlier, the compartmentalization of things. Like, they, I think, trying to say, okay, today I have to do 3 social media posts instead of just, like, as something pops up, oh, this might be cool to do, kind of, you know, and just thinking of it more fluidly and less. I think they try to step in and think of it in a business sense too much sometimes. And I'm like, just relax and, like, lean into it and do what feels good to you. We can do all the stuff that's not fun.
That's a beautiful point, because back in the day, you hear all these stories about, especially in acting, how, you know, take anyone from Judy Garland down the list, how they were so controlled and manipulated and basically tortured by the business and the people running the businesses, because they had to protect the image so much. Today, we're in this transition point, and we're on the other side of it, obviously, now at this point, but it's still transitioning in some way, where it is okay to just let people see you every day, what you feel, how you feel, and it's okay.
You don't have to look perfect. You don't have to have a perfect body. You don't have to have a perfect anything.
And you have, you still have to be, you have to be cautious of what you say and how you say it at times, so you don't get in trouble if you're just a dumb and say something dumb, right? Or if you're not a good person and something comes out.
Because you have to be intentional and care about, you know, the human being that you are.
Letting people see you as a human has become more of a norm and desirable than the perfection. And it's cool to hear you talk about your role in that and the label's role in that. And to remind artists that it's not about a number. It's not about, you know, again, being perfect or hitting all the notes all the time, but it's really how can we all together as a team take you to where you're dreaming to go with your art and just, again, be human and authentic in that process. It's That made my day right there, because I can't tell you how many times I've said, you know, Jason over at that label, he's just a jerk and I hate labels. And
no, in fact, Jason, how can the people maybe reach out to you and get in touch with you or find you online?
If he wants that.
I'm kind of on lockdown online.
Yeah,
so,
he's kind of he's a lockdown.
I am not one of those public facing people. I like to hide in the in the shadows and work with the public facing people.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah, well, thanks for being with us today. This was fantastic. I loved it.
This is amazing. Thank you so first much. Podcast ever.
His first podcast.
You were
big
great.
Hand, everyone.
You were
it's
great.
Like you've done it every day.
Yeah,
it's not my first time talking. So
well, that's for sure.
Neither us.
Well, hey, thanks for joining us today. Once again, Jason Jenkins, the senior VP at Curb Records. Thanks for being with us today. It was awesome.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, see you guys next time.
Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to the Vocal Lab podcast. Ready to join the top ranks of the music industry? Don't forget to follow and subscribe for more first-class conversations that make the extraordinary your new ordinary. Until next time, keep striving for your top note.